Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed. Or, in this case, I leave it for a week and then do the review and then stick it up here on the podcast feed whenever I get bandwidth to upload it. I went to the French juggling convention and that kind of delayed a lot of things, not just this podcast, but other podcast projects and other hobbies. I didn't play music, any piano or guitar or sing at all for 9, 10, 11 days in a row or something like that. So it's not just the podcasting that fell behind. However, I did keep reading. I had a book on the go as an audio book. I finished one book, this book, Solaris, and I've started the next one already. But so let's get to this review. Not a lot of other news. Oh, please, yeah. So if you do have any book suggestions, I might as well just say this here at the beginning. Email me, luke@juggler.net, or recommend the book via goodreads.com. My profile is on there, Luke Burridge, or goodreads.com/Luke Burridge. You can follow my reviews or become a friend or just recommend some books for me there with a message. But I do want to suggest something. If you go to sfbrp.com, you can click on the episode lists link, and they're on a page. There's all of the episodes listed by episode number, also by subjective star rating, the ratings out of 5 stars, and also by author as well. So if you check that out, please check it out, because there's lots of people saying, oh, have you reviewed this book or have you reviewed that book? Because I know it's a bit difficult to look through the list. I'll just look through the blog posts on the website or even just the list on the RSS feed, like that you get in iTunes or something like that. You can actually check it out, like sort them by author or sort them by number, episode number, or by or by the star rating, so you can see the books. If you just want to read the books that I hate, or if you just want to read the books that I love, or if you just want to listen to the reviews of the books that I hate and get the rants and stuff like that, because lots of people ask for that kind of thing. They recommend bad books for me to read just so they can get a rant out of it. It's like, yeah, great, that's not going to work. I enjoy reading good books like this book. So, let's get to it. Solaris by Stanislaw Lem, or Stanisław Lem. I'm going to call him Stanislaw Lem. Polish author, very, very popular in Europe and I guess in sort of the Eastern Bloc countries. Now, this is a book that is probably the single most... I say this about quite a few books, but there's a series of books which lots of people ask me to read and review. And this one always has been popular ever since I started doing this podcast. People say, oh, you should read Solaris and things. So, but I've never really... never really got round to it, I guess. It's a bit tricky. But there was a new translation out on Audible, and so I was thinking, that's a bit weird. So I checked Wikipedia for the history of this book. It was published in 1961 in Polish, and then in 1966 it was translated into French, and then that French copy in 1970 was translated into English. But Lem was unhappy with the translation, but the publishers had rights to the English translation, and as long as the book remained in print, Lem couldn't then resell the rights or the translation rights or the English language rights or the foreign language rights, whatever it was, across, because the publisher held all the rights to the book. So even though he was unhappy with the English translation, that's the only one that he'd get because the publishers never did anything differently. But then along comes Audible, and they have obviously got the rights to the audio version of it. So they commissioned a brand new translation, direct Polish to English translation, official translation for the first time. Of course, I can't compare the two translations because I've never read the other English translation. And who knows, maybe this English version, this new Audible English translation, will be translated into print. Not translated into print, like, you know, released as print, but, you know, who knows, whatever. So the audiobook, just under 8 hours, about 200 pages. That's what it comes to, roughly. So let's get on to this. So this book is set, the world of this book is set a long time in the future. Our end of the galaxy is well explored. We've got faster than light travel and things like that. And what is discovered is at one point is this binary star, and then there's a planet going around this star. And they always think, okay, well, it doesn't matter if there's any planets going around a binary star system, because that'll always perturb the orbit in such ways that life can't exist. But then Solaris is discovered under some weird circumstances. Solaris is a planet, and it had this weird orbit that that seemed to keep itself a bit too steady. So when they went to look at the place, they discovered it was an ocean world covered in sea. But then they looked a bit closer and the ocean wasn't just water. In fact, it wasn't water at all. It was a single living organism. But was it living or was it what was going on and stuff like that? So scientists started exploring this ocean and they examine it over a period of a few hundred years. And they work out, you know, I mean, this is discussed in a lot of depth in the book, but they work out that it is some kind of alien organism. But is it intelligent? Is it conscious? Nobody can really work it out. So that's what the scientists examine over a long time. And a lot of the book, like I say, talks about this. But then over the years, the outpost, the scientific outpost, no longer has hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, investigating it at the same time. By the time the book is written, or that when the setting of the book, only four people are stationed on the planet. So it's almost become the mystery was too great. Science couldn't get to the bottom of it, and so by the time the book takes place, like I say, there's just this, and the base isn't on the sea or any of the land on the planet. It's this anti-gravity floating platform that floats out there above the sea. And 99% of the action takes place in this time and in this place. The plot is such so how do I explain this? So the book starts with our protagonist Chris Kelvin. He arrives at Solaris and he is like a young scientist, or maybe what, like 20, no, like 30 something years old. It's his first visit to Solaris, but he's been studying it for the last 10 years of his life. And on the day that he turns up, he realizes some things are a bit weird. The lead scientist and his old sort of like scientific mentor, I think his name is Gilberian, he has just committed suicide on the day that Chris Kelvin was turning up. That's a bit weird, of course. And then Snout is another scientist, and he's obviously very upset about something too, and but he won't say what's going on. And then Sartorius is another scientist, the last scientist who is based on this outpost on Solaris, and he has locked himself in his lab and won't leave for any reason and won't come out and see Chris Kelvin, even though he says, hey, normally when there's a new arrival, everyone comes out and meets them because it's a big thing. It's, you know, there's lots going on. It's a day when someone turns up with a delivery, but nothing as well at that. So something fishy is going on, and Chris is going, well, what's happening here? And he hears voices and he hears footsteps, and then suddenly, this is happens right near the beginning of the book, so I'm not giving too much of a spoiler away. He spots this woman walking through the station, a black woman, and he's like, wait a second, this is obviously not the station scientist. You know, shouldn't be anyone, or this isn't anyone who should be based here on the station. And she just walks past as nothing's happening and then goes away, and, you know, he follows her but can't find her again. So Chris talks to Snout, and Snout says, I'm not going to explain. Even though you've seen this weird visitor, I'm not going to explain. You'll understand soon enough. And true enough, Kelvin's ex-wife turns up on the station. Her name is Rhea. And we find out that when Chris Kelvin left his studying, when he left to begin studying Solaris, he didn't go to Solaris, but he left and sort of like let his research career take over. His wife, ex-wife, Rhea, took it as a rejection and then committed suicide by injecting herself with poison. And she'd warned Chris that she would do this, but he didn't believe her. He didn't think she was strong enough as a person to go through with suicide, but she did anyway. And of course, he blames himself. I'll talk more about this whole situation with Rhea and his past in a bit. But it turns out that all the other station scientists have had visitors too, people from their past. And except for this woman who walks past Chris at one point, we don't meet any of the visitors except Chris's visitor, because each of the scientists keeps his visitor to himself. And I won't go into too much more in case of spoilers, but you get the idea sort of where the story is going. In 1960, I guess this idea of like this super powerful alien using the memories of humans to try and communicate with them or to test them or to do something, it might have been new. But now we've had this same kind of thing over and over in many different books as well. It reminds me a lot, of course, you know, Alistair Reynolds was writing long, long, long after this book, but in the, his Revelation space novels, he often talks about this globe-spanning life form in ocean planets called the Pattern Jugglers, and these can swallow humans and sometimes recreate them based on their memories, or recreate other people based on their memories. I think that's the kind of thing that happens as well. And that's kind of what the Solaris Ocean is doing here. Again, I don't want to spoil it too much, but that's the that is the root of the problems. And that is, of course, posited and explained very early on in the book. And like I say, we've seen this so many other times now in science fiction that it's, like I say, it might have been new at the time, but it's quite predictable what's going on here. It's not really a mystery. That isn't the main mystery. That's not the main thrust of the story. But, you know, things play out sometimes in sweet ways, more often in quite horrific ways. You know, the scientists are trying to study the ocean, but of course they're being studied in return. The plot is, like I say, quite simple, but I really did enjoy it. It's well done, and it's short as well. I didn't have to listen to, you know, 24 hours or 48 hours worth of story to get through all of this kind of stuff. It's only an 8-hour audiobook, or 200-page book, but this version is, of course, the audiobook version that I did. So, a bit about the characters there. There's actually, like I say, the story is quite simple, but this really isn't so much of a story as an exploration of, like, one man's mind, one man's character. And in that way, it reminded me quite a lot of another old book that I reviewed here, which is I Am Legend by Richard Matheson. Because in that one, we have a similar kind of setup. This is, instead of being an ocean that recreates his dead wife, it's a zombie vampire plague that makes his wife come back from the dead. And in both books, the protagonist has to sort of, like, you know, deal with this, his past and the things that happens in his past. And of course, Robert Neville in I Am Legend has to re-kill and bury his ex-wife and things like that. And I was thinking, well, what's going to happen with Kelvin? Of course, I don't read it to find out. I'll listen to the audiobook to find out. But like I say, Kelvin is, it's a book about an ocean, but it's really about, this exploration into a man's past and him dealing with, you know, grief and responsibility. And Kelvin is quite interesting because he's a scientist and a psychologist. Unlike, say, you know, Robert Neville in I Am Legend, who was just a guy whose friend was a scientist. Or was he a scientist? But he became a scientist in that regard. But here, because Kelvin is a psychologist, you see him thinking things through in a very analytical way, and he's going, right, okay, so am I going mad here? Well, I'm going to test myself if I'm going to go mad, but, you know, how can I know I'm going mad? If my brain is going mad, how can it test if it's going mad? And he does this kind of, like, analytical way. But then at the same time, he completely lets his emotions run away with his self-control. And I love the interplay that you sort of see going on in his mind. He's admitting some things to himself, and then he's acting on other things. So you realize, you know, his actions and the things that he's thinking aren't matching up. So there's a lot of stuff going on in his subconscious that he is hiding from himself. Very interesting kind of thing. So his wife... I'm going to skip back to this because I realize in my notes that this is the main thematic stuff. So let me go skip forward here in my notes to... I'll get back to the other characters as well, because I think this is important to talk about in the thematic stuff. So, into the science and technology stuff. When Kelvin first arrives on the station, he picks up a book and he starts reading about the history of Solaris. And I quite enjoyed that because I thought, oh, that's interesting. You know, it's a clever way of bringing in, instead of just going, oh, and this is going to be the backstory, like, because everything happens in the moment and everything happens from the point of view of our point of view character, of Kelvin. We only really find out about the history of Solaris and the science and technology of Solaris, of the planet and of the book and of the worlds that the book is set in, when either Kelvin thinks about it, or when he picks up a book and reads about it, or when somebody else picks up a book and reads about it and he's thinking about what that person is reading about. And so much of it is done this, like, literally, like, throughout the book he just keeps on picking up books and reading, and then we just get a long extract about, you know, this scientist and this theory and this story of Solaris. And it's good and bad in a way. Bad in that it feels really clunky, but good in that, you know, let me put it this way, it could have been portrayed more elegantly, but it's good that it gives us a break from all of, like, the mind-bending exploration of, you know, human memory and relationships, which is what the book is about here. the actual level of the science, of course, it's sort of like lots of classic 1960s science fiction stuff. You've got like the readers and the tape machines and the microfiche instead of, you know, data and hard drives and stuff like that. But blah, 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 blah. Well, it's to be expected, I guess. You know, nobody really predicted the internet and all the different communications that we have now. But that's good. But and then you've got the science of the ocean, and the whole point of that the ocean is that it's like, or one of the main points is that it's beyond our understanding, like almost magical level of technology here. So which is good, because then he can make it do what he wants, and he can make it as big as he wants, and as elaborate as he wants, and technical as he wants. And as we read about the different classifications of the way that the ocean moves and contracts and displays its different movements and things, again, I don't want to spoil it too much, but he can make that as elaborate and as well described as he wants to. But what I also enjoyed about the science is like the meta-science stuff, because a lot of it is writing about the scientific process and about the subject, you know, excuse me, I need to sneeze here. So a lot of the writing is about a scientific process where the area of study is a subject which is beyond understanding. So it's how humans work within the scientific community, but there's a lot more comparison to sort of religion and faith and theology, and even in a way psychology, in the way that, you know, people can come up with theories of the mind, but there's very difficult ways to test them, because, you know, and this is what we get in the book as well, where Chris Kelvin tries to test his own mind from within his own mind. It's like trying to test the rules of the universe from within the rules of the universe, or to test theology from within the rules of theology. And so I thought that was quite an interesting exploration of, you know, like they say, the way that humans work in a scientific community. But it's very different from what you'd think about physics or chemistry, because then it's more like, because there it's about the rules and it's about, you know, the scientific progress. But when it's very difficult to make any progress, or in the case of like theology or religion, it's impossible to make progress towards any goal, which is, I mean, I'm not saying that theology isn't a process. There is a big process to it there, but any one person's character and any one person's faith or any one person's viewpoint or their intellect can sway masses and masses of people towards a different way of thinking about it, because there is an absence of evidence. And here we have the same thing. In the absence of evidence, a single character can dominate science, and then their contribution can be completely overthrown by another dominant character. Whereas I find that in like physics or chemistry or mathematics or all these other sort of like harder sciences, a single person's character doesn't really influence them. Like say someone like Freud in the psychology of the mind, it can, you know, their or his contribution can sort of be shown to be, you know, a good working model or a nice guideline, but ultimately flawed in a way that isn't, so it's no longer useful in any way. And I guess the same thing can happen with political theory as well. You can have a great thinker, and then their ideas can be well thought out, they can be systematic, they can be thematic and all that kind of stuff, but then they can sort of be overthrown by a later thinker, whereas science is, you know, the stronger science is more based on data and results and things like that. So because it's more of an exploration of what science is, it can stand up remarkably well. But like I say, it's about a book about concepts and a book about humans rather than the science and technology that takes place. They go, oh, they built an anti-gravity station. I'm like, yeah, fine, no problem at all. And I can forgive the, oh, anti-gravity or gravity force fields or this and that. And I can, or a microscope that can zoom in past the level of atoms. And I'm like, yeah, no problem, I can go with that, because I can see that the ideas behind the science are well thought out, even if the invention themselves don't really stand up to scientific technology or scientific understanding or technological abilities that we understand are possible today. Like, you know, just like the faster than light, I don't mind that they went, oh yeah, faster than light, that's fine, because like I say, we see the scientists work through more complex problems, or even not work through more complex problems. The writing is pretty good writing. Again, it's a translation. I can't compare the translation, but it's good. I guess the basis of the story is very good, and there's lots of interesting imagery under there as well. The narration by Alessandro Giuliani is very good. He does a great job with the voices of the different characters. Snout, I really, really enjoyed his voice and the way he was brought to life, his character was brought to life. And also Rhea, Chris's reincarnated dead ex-wife, Again, great voice there as well, like a very soft voice, but it almost like an alien soft voice as well. One thing that I did pick up with the writing, though, is the adverbs. I even made a note of some of these here. Let me check them out. The adverbs, there's in just one little bit, sort of unrelentingly, I unthinkingly put my feet into my slippers as I stepped slowly backwards. As I stepped slowly backwards, it's just that kind of turn of phrase that I go, really? As I stepped slowly backwards. This is a translation. You don't have to translate it word for word. I'm sure that in the Polish, that's not what he did. You can change this into better things, you know. Oh, there's a one, he looked searchingly into my face. He looked searchingly into my face? He searched my face? No. There's different ways that you can say that, but it is a bit clunky, and other people have sent me emails about this as well, especially when I did the review of... No, I didn't do the review, but when I read On Writing by Stephen King, he really goes into this. This is one of his big bugbears, so it does jump out at me as someone who has read about writing and about things to avoid as well, like that. Let me see if I can find the translation. I don't think I made a note of the translator, and I do want to give that here because I think it'd be a bit uncool for me to not give the name. I copied the Wikipedia page here as well. So the Polish text was translated into English by Bill Johnston with the approval of Lem's estate. So there you go, Bill Johnston. Pretty good translation, I guess. I don't know. I don't have the comparison. I should maybe do the AB comparison, read the original version, but that's not high on my priorities here. So as I've got the Wikipedia page open here, I'll get onto some of the themes of the book. Now, Wikipedia, because I wanted to look up this... let me see. I've lost it here on my notes. Maybe I'll talk about that in a bit. So let me go back to the... I'm really lost track here because I wrote some notes here and then I wanted to go back to them. So let me talk a bit about the relationships in this book. But this is the thematic stuff because we do spend a lot of time with Chris and his wife. I would just want to get a bit personal here and talk a bit about my relationships. And maybe I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but when I am single and I'm looking for a girlfriend, if I'm looking for a girlfriend, not always looking for a girlfriend, but I have sort of like a checklist of maybe 10 points, maybe something like that. Not so much a checklist, but like a list of things that I need in a perfect girl for me to be in a relationship with them, or a serious relationship. You know, I do a lot of dating when I'm single and do all this kind of stuff, and I don't mind flings here and there and romances here and there. But, you know, if I'm looking for a serious relationship, or if I find someone who I think I might want a serious relationship with, there is a certain set number of things that I want to keep in my mind. And it might sound a bit shallow to do this, but, you know, I want to find someone who I find, you know, effortlessly physically attractive. And the idea isn't just because, oh, I'm shallow, but I want to know that if I'm 4 months into a relationship, these little things that niggle me after 4 years and or you know, after 4 months in a relationship, or if they're just a mild concern at the beginning of a relationship, 4 months in, they're going to be a real niggle, and a year into it, it's going to be really bad. You know, when the like original honeymoon period or the original feelings of that, you know, that immediate attraction because someone is new and interesting and things like that. That'll wear off, and these, you know, these niggling things will still be there. For, you know, say like physically attractive, has a sense of humor. Another one is having good teeth. Now, this might sound like a weird thing to do, but I want to kiss someone and not worry about what I'm kissing when I'm kissing them. So, good teeth is definitely on the list, on my checklist of perfect woman. And people who've been listening to this podcast for a long time will know that I was in a long term relationship with a girl called Pola. We were together for like 4.5 years, and good teeth was on my list before I got together with her, and her teeth was perfect because her father was a dentist, so of course her teeth are perfect. But it's just one of those little bonuses that jumps out at you when, you know, you meet someone and they fulfill all the things. Another one is not a long distance relationship, which I messed up last year and managed to get myself into a long distance relationship, which didn't work out. Another one is I have to be emotionally available, because there's nothing worse than getting together with someone and thinking that they're going to have a good relationship with them and then realizing that, oh, wait a second, you're still in love with your ex-boyfriend. You know, that kind of thing does happen. And one thing that has to be important. That's what I want to talk about here, is that they have to be passionate about something, which isn't me. Like, I'm passionate about, you know, juggling and music and reading and writing and all these different kind of things, photography. And I want to know that when someone's with me, they're not going to mind me having a camera in my hand and taking photos of them, because they've got to understand that I have a passion. But also, I want them to have a passion, which is something that I don't share with them. Or maybe I do share with them, but them doing something with me can't be their main hobby or their main passion that they do when they're not working, or something like that. And this really resonates with me because, how to explain this? Well, let me put it this way. Back in 2003, I had a very bad breakup with a girl. I refer to her as my psycho ex-girlfriend. And I don't want to get too much into the story, but it came to the point where I didn't want to be with, in fact, I wasn't even with her at the time, but it had been this on-off relationship. And I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll invite her over and stop, put an end to it for real, because I've quit my job and I want to go traveling and I want to spend some time away. And I want to tell her that I don't want to be with her, and I don't want her to be, I don't want to be in a relationship with her, because it was quite a weird, not healthy, very unhealthy, very emotionally unavailable, weird kind of relationship that I was staying in because of different things, you know, bad advice from other people, thinking I was doing the good thing, pity. Don't stay with people out of pity, guys or girls. It's really not a good thing. So in my attempt to, when she came over, to explain to her that I didn't want to be with her anymore, and that because I didn't want to go away traveling, because my plan was to go to Thailand for 3 months or to go traveling for a few months, and I didn't want to be stuck in a relationship, and I didn't want her to be stuck in a relationship. This might sound a bit callous, but the reason why we kept breaking up was because she kept on having sex with other people. Weird. It's a weird situation. Really unhealthy to be in. Anyway, she decided that she didn't want anything of this, and that if I couldn't have her, nobody could have her. And if she couldn't have me, nobody could have me. So cue the worst, most stressful night of my life, when someone was trying to blackmail me into having sex with them or else they were going to kill themselves, was smashing stuff, trying to stab me, you know, really nasty kind of really nasty evening. This is why I call her my psycho ex-girlfriend. It ended up that she was in hospital for a few days, 3 days, as a result of a drug overdose, and it kind of screwed me up for ages. Let me explain this. When you have sex with someone and they try and like strangle you during sex, but not in like a cool sexy way, but like in a, and then try and like try and break a glass over your head and try and stab you with scissors after having sex with them, because they said they were going to hurt themselves if you didn't have sex with them, really, it really can screw you up for ages. So like I say, having passions other than me and being able to get on with life, you know, it's not just a you know, I don't want to be the only thing that they're thinking about. I want them to be able to spend time and attention on someone, something else but me. And, you know, because, like, if I'm not going to be there, and it's not just on a selfish level, but it's like, if I break up with them, how are they going to feel? How are they going to take it? If I break up with someone, are they going to end up in hospital for 3 days after a drug overdose? Am I going to ruin their life breaking up with them and things? So, of course, this is going to be on my list, like, don't get together with someone who is a psycho ex-girlfriend. Anyway, so what we have here in this book is something that resonated very strongly with me, because Rhea, Chris's ex-wife, was obviously this kind of thing. He had a passion which was stronger than his relationship with Ray. He was like, no, I'm going to go off and I'm going to study Solaris. This means a lot to me, and I'm not going to be able to spend as much time for you. Rhea took this as a rejection of her and a rejection of the relationship. And, you know, when Chris left, she said, no, I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to commit suicide. And she had the means to do it because, you know, Chris had, there was some, in, you know, some poisonous or some drugs there that if she injected that could have killed it. And he thought, no, she's not strong enough to do this. Now, of course, my psycho ex-girlfriend wasn't strong enough to kill herself properly. I mean, she gave it a good try, but it didn't really work as well as Rhea did, because she actually did kill herself. So what we have here is this, let me explain this. It's a bit difficult for me to explain, but like I say, Rhea was this uncomplicated woman who Kelvin loved in a way, but he obviously didn't love her as much as his guilt tells him he should have. And looking back, he realizes that, of course, he did love her in some ways, but he didn't love her. And again, this is too complicated and a bit personal for me as well. But, oh yeah, that's what I wanted to say. Passions other than him. Of course, he was her only passion. This reborn Rhea that he gets to, that turns up again, he actually realizes that his feelings for the reborn, you know, Solaris recreated Rhea, is stronger or is different in a way, because the Rhea that is reborn is more complex. She is based on his memories, she isn't the Rhea that was. She has to act out in certain ways according to the plan of Solaris. We don't understand what Solaris's plan is at the beginning, but whatever those plans might be, she has this ulterior motive than just being together with Kelvin as she did as a real person. And so Kelvin starts looking at her and going, wow, I actually find her more appealing as a person because she has a different motive. She has an ulterior motive, which isn't just being with me. It's actually to fulfill her plans or to find out who she is, because, you know, Rhea starts wondering, you know, where she is or where she comes from, or why she is where she is, and things like that. But we get an interplay of this. We get an interplay where she can't stand being apart from Kelvin, but not just on an emotional level. It's not that she just doesn't want to be alone, but if she's left alone, her personality will start reverting to her base personality based on, you know, which was recreated from Kelvin's memories. And her personality starts to fade and reset. So she doesn't want to spend any time out of eye contact or out of sight of Kelvin. And the more time that she does spend with him, the more she grows as a person. And so that brings on an entirely different, you know, dynamic into this character and interplay from what would be just the psycho ex-girlfriend or psycho ex-wife. Suddenly she becomes a new and more valid as a person, even though she's not a real human. She isn't, you know, she's just based on his memories, but she actually becomes a better person, not because she's based purely on his memories, but because she isn't, because she has a different dynamic. So that really stood out to me in this book. Other characters, which I wanted to get to here as well, Snout, this other scientist that Kelvin interacts with and talks with a bit, we never meet his visitor, and we never find out much about his past. And the same with Sartorius. He's even more mysterious, because not only do we not meet his visitor, but we only talk to him once or twice, but sort of like through a door or over the telephone, or it's like over a video phone, but the camera's been covered up, so you can't see it. So we just talk to him on the phone. And Sartorius's character may or may not be a child. And, you know, we're not sure what's going on in his past. But with Snout as well, he's obviously got some weird stuff in his past, which is, because it's left as mysterious, it makes him more appealing, and it makes the mystery more appealing. At one point, you know, Kelvin looks at Snout and he realizes Snout has blood on his hands. Literally, not just blood on his hands, but literally blood on his hands. And he goes, oh, what has he been doing? Is it his blood? Is it his visitor's blood? What's going on here? And I don't want to give too much away, but there's some quite horrific passages in this book. But the more horrific stuff you realise isn't going on with Kelvin and Rhea, because it's his ex-wife, you know, and it was obviously this loving relationship. But the guilt and responsibility that Snout and Sartorius is being tested with by the ocean, we never get to see it, and it sounds a lot more horrific. It's like they're locked away, and it's weird that, you know, Kelvin doesn't want to talk to them. He doesn't find out what's going on there, and as the readers of this book, we never find out. Oh, this is what I want to say. Ah, I found it now, this note here. So let me go over to the Wikipedia page that I found. Some people say this book is about communicating with aliens and how difficult that might be. In the same way that I guess, you know, I meant, oh no, it was just an email that I mentioned before, in Speaker for the Dead by Orson Scott Card, they talk about, you know, and the same with Ender's Game, it's about, you know, being able to communicate with aliens and things like that. But I didn't, you know, that's what I said. On Wikipedia it says, Solaris is one of Lem's philosophical explorations of man's anthropomorphic limitations. Another passage here. Solaris chronicles the ultimate futility of attempted communications with extraterrestrial alien life on a far distant planet. The extraterrestrial mind of Solaris is so greatly different from human mind, from the human mind of objective consciousness, that attempts at interspecies communications are a dismal failure. So, as you can see, the whole alien planet thing, you know, sure, alien, you know, interspecies communications. If that's what you want to take away from this book, if you think that's what this book is about, great. But I take it as a metaphor for communication between humans. The scientists spend hundreds of years studying the alien ocean and they get nowhere. And that's the same thing that they've done with humans. We see this over and over again, is that we think, ah, now we understand the mind, but the mind is too complicated. Oh, now we understand how humans think, but it's too complicated. Now we understand this. Oh, economics is all about this, but it's not. And then this is this, and this is not. And we see that over and over again. Humans are more complicated than humans can understand. And if I ever get round to writing or finish writing and releasing the third book in my Minding Tomorrow series of novels, you'll understand why this is a big appeal to me, is that the only way that we can, that the consciousness can exist in a way, is that it's non-understandable. And even this alien consciousness, if it is or not, it's totally non-understandable. It's non-mappable to our own experiences. Underneath the surface, there's way more going on than we'll ever see. And Kelvin has just as much success in communicating with the ocean, this weird alien ocean, as he does with the other human scientists on board the station. To be honest, he doesn't really try to communicate with either of them very much. And we only get to see the very surface, like say, of these other characters. We get to see them, the whole parts of them, whole facets of their personality are locked away. Literally, they keep them locked away behind doors. And they only ever talk on the phone when you can't see them. Snout has blood on his hand. What does it mean? Whose blood is it? You know, you've got all these different questions going on. And we go through life, I think, like these scientists. We only ever see the surface of people. And we never really find out what makes them tick inside. As I was writing up some of these notes, there was a man sitting opposite me on the train, and there was a woman beside me on the train. And as I was thinking about this, when I was just making some of these notes, I was like, is it possible to know what they think? Or is it like Sartorius and Snout on this thing? Is it good to know? Should we know? Should we want to find out? Or should we care? Is it out any of our business? Or, you know, are we going to find good stuff in the past? The only person in this novel that we actually really fully understand, including the protagonist, is not the protagonist, but his wife. And the reason why we understand him, that person, his wife, completely, is because she is made up purely of his own memories. And this resonates with me because I do this at the same time. That, like, I think about people in my past all the time, you know, like family members or ex-girlfriends or friends or things like that. And even I think about myself in the past. And when I think about them in the past and things that I've done in the past, all the motivations are clear. Now, this could be the motivations are clear because in hindsight we can see what people were thinking, but I think it's more complicated than that. I don't think so that it's just hindsight. I think it's because what happens is that you think about the situation and you make a certain outline of the situation in your mind and you think, oh, well, that person obviously thought about it in this way and that's why they did that. And over time, your memories sort of meld around the idea. You get this sort of like selective bias to what you remember and what you don't remember. You forget the contradicting memories or the memories of evidence that go against it, or, you know, and you're left with this perfect and reasonable view of people's actions in the past in ways that are completely understandable. And you do it with your own self as well. I mean, I think back to things that I did, and at the time, I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea what I was thinking. But looking back now, I realize, oh, that's why I did that. It was because of this person. Oh, that's why I did that, because I wanted to take this view in life. I was listening to this podcast a while ago. Well, it's a podcast which, you know, I don't know how many episodes out, 20 episodes now, with Merlin Mann and Dan Benjamin, called Back to Work. And in a recent podcast, Merlin said that random chance has led me to do so many better things in my life than my best decision-making process has ever done. All of the things that he's consciously decided to do have led to things which are okay, but all the things that have come up to him just in random chance have led to many better things. Now, I talk about this same kind of outlook in life in episode 100, where I talk about personal my personal philosophy as influenced by time travel and thoughts about that kind of stuff, is that when this random chance comes up, I need to be in a position where when something randomly happens, I can take full advantage of that. And mere chaos and stuff like that, I can take advantage of that and become a better person and go on to different things. But that's what happens as well. Like me becoming a professional juggler, I can look back and say, oh yeah, I always knew I was going to become a professional juggler because of this and because of that. And that's why I went into juggling, and that's why I went to college and stuff. But that's not true. If I always knew I wanted to become a professional juggler, I wouldn't have gone to university to study music and then go off and do TV stuff. I'd have just worked on the juggling straight away as well. So what you have, you've got all this perfect, reasonable view of the past, and you can. I think most people do this, and that's what Kelvin has done. There's no way that his life, or let me put this, there's no way that his wife, to talk about it in that way, was as he remembered. She didn't only kill herself because he left and that she wasn't strong enough to live without him. That's no way the full story, but that's the story he got, and that's the story he remembered. So that is what she is now. In the same way that I can't talk about my psycho ex-girlfriend, oh, she was like this because of this and she was doing that. I'm not gonna I don't want to. In some ways I know I do this, but I don't want to project my own understanding of somebody's character and personality onto them in a way that I think I understand them. I know that I'm never going to understand them with that much complexity. And, you know, it's sort of like, oh yeah, she did this because she did X because of Y, and it wasn't because of X, or, you know, it wasn't because of Y, it was because of A and D and M, and Y was just a symptom, and X was just a symptom as well. Neither of them were the cause, they were just the symptoms. So yeah, that's what we get here with Kelvin and him talking about his ex-wife. Everything is plain with her. Everything is simple. Everything is worked out. So we get to know her as a person based on memories. And I think what Stanislav Lem is doing here is very clever. He's talking about our memories of other people's motivations and how they're all so clear. And this is what happens in relationships as well. Someone does something and the motivation is totally clear. Oh, you did this because you wanted to hurt me, or you did this because of this, or you did this because of that. And in the breakups, all of these different things come out, and we've already rationalized the other person's actions and their thought process and everything, and we know what they're thinking. The truth is, it's always more complex than that. And Kelvin in this book is way more complex than what he thinks he is at the time, and we can see that with his conflicting actions and thoughts, whereas his wife is very clear because, like I say, she's based on this idealized memories of what she was. And we don't get that at all with Snout and Sartorius. All we get is the surface. We don't know why they do what they do. We don't even get guesses of their motivations based on their time-perfected memories of their past grievances with people who affected them emotionally and things like that. And Kelvin doesn't try and second-guess them because he knows that he can't second-guess them. He even says at some point, I'm not going to try and work out who their visitor is. I'm not going to try and work out what is there. It's probably a lot worse than me or what I'm going through, and etc., etc. And of course, this, to bring it back to my original point here, we get that to an even greater extent with the ocean, where the ocean is, humans aren't, let me put it this way, the idea that humans can't communicate with an alien being is just the ultimate expression of our difficulties with communicating with each other. And this book isn't about the ocean and isn't about humans trying to communicate them. That's just a metaphor for the difficulty that we have communicating with each other and putting our own idealized memories and thoughts and motivations onto other people. And that's, I think that's why I really enjoyed Snout and Sartorius, is that if for once in the book that the viewpoint character or even the author didn't try and explain their motivations or try and explain their thought processes too much. He intentionally left them as blank canvases as a contrast as an accompaniment to the ocean and as a contrast to Kelvin and his ex-wife. So yeah, I mean, enough of that. I guess it might be in the book when you read it. It was certainly in the book when I read it, and it could have been there when Lem wrote it. I'm going to give him enough credit because these ideas had to be somewhere in his mind as he wrote the book. Even if they were only in his subconscious, they definitely came out onto the page, and this was definitely the kind of things that he was thinking about while he was reading this book. So that's all I have to say about the book. Hopefully you enjoyed that exploration. Like I say, read the book and you get a different version, or you'll probably be able to take away a lot of different things about this book. But it did give me a lot to think about. And like I say, I managed to identify this with this book on a very personal way, and it talked about lots of things that I already enjoy thinking about. And I don't think it taught me anything new, or like I say, a lot of these ideas I've seen in other books, and even in my own thoughts and in my own writings, I try and bring these kind of things out. But yeah, there you go. 4 stars, might as well. I made a note here as well. I mentioned this before, that if you look at the list of books that I read, I try and avoid bad books, because of course I read for my own enjoyment. I'm not a reviewer that is reading books to try and weed out good books or weed out the bad books so you don't have to read them. Sometimes that happens, but generally I want to read books that I know I'm going to enjoy. More than 2.5 stars, 2.5 stars, is a good book as well. So if it's 3 stars, I would say that it's worth reading. If it's 2 stars, it's probably not worth reading. And if it's in between, you know, well, it's your call. And according to the episode list, it's now 11 books in a row that I've given more than 3 stars to. And most of them is 4 or 4.5 stars as well. And so, like I say, I get emails all the time saying bad books give better rants and things like that. But I'm really happy that I can review a book like this and not have to rant at all. I enjoy the ideas that you can get out of a well-written book and a well-thought-out book and a well-told story. And a book like... Oh, let me just bring up the episode list here as well. Where is it? So if I bring it up here, say a book like... Let me skip back to... a book like Hunters of Dune. Like, what am I... Brian Herbert, Kevin Jameson, what the hell am I going to find to talk about there, which isn't just ranting against the book? It doesn't do... Like, what's this? Demon. I was told it's pronounced demon, not Damon. Hominids, it was trying so hard to give me things to think about, but it was written at such a pathetically base level, and Calculating God as well, exactly the pathetically base level, that there's nothing to talk about, there's nothing to think about. Red Thunder by John Varley, what a load of shit. And it's like, oh, we're going to go into space, we're going to go to Mars. And it's just like, yeah, sure, I can rant to go about those books, but I'd much rather they stimulate thought and stimulate discussion and stimulate life-changing ideas in people. And I think that's what this book could be to some people. In fact, let's check out, I loaded up here the I've lost the Goodreads. Oh shit, no, I closed Firefox by accident, so I don't have the Goodreads page and I'm not connected to the internet at the moment, so I can't see what other people thought about it. Maybe I can find it here. Goodreads, no, that's from the mobile version. I didn't get it. So can't say what other people think, but it's probably 3 to 3.5, 4 stars on goodreads.com, especially among my friends. So that's it from me for this book. I hope you enjoyed all of that blah, blah, blahing. Email me, luke@juggler.net with any recommendations or thoughts, or if you want to chat or got any things that you want to tell me to read or not read or anything like that. Email me. Follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurridge on Twitter. You can check out my blog, lukeburge.com/blog, and I'm getting to the last episode in my other podcast series that's out at the moment, Luke's Creative Podcast. You can find that at lukeburge.com/creative. Otherwise, that's it. Check out sfbrp.com and click on episode lists to see all of the books, and I think that's a good way to find books that and reviews that you're interested in reading. You can just click straight on the blog post and download them, or get them from iTunes from the list or something like that. That's it from me, and I'll catch you next time.